Welcome to Ars Politica, a podcast on political life, culture, and Christian political theory, with Stephen Wolfe and Thomas Acord. We seek to revitalize the Christian West and to restore the dignity, strength, and self-respect of Western civilization.
All right, welcome back to Ars Politica podcast. Today we have a special guest. We have Nate Fisher, and we're here to talk about institutions and evangelicalism and a little bit about the future of the American right. So Nate is the founder of New Founding and an American reformer. And we're glad to have you. Thank you. Thank you for being here, Nate.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks, Thomas.
All right. So the first thing, you have these two new projects, New Founding, American Reformer. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're trying to do with those, with either of those?
Sure. So they're related in terms of their broad mission. New Founding. I'll start with New Founding since that's the broader one, and then I'll talk about where American Reformer fits in relationship with that. My background is as an investor and in business, who's really come into active focus on politics more recently. And I did that as I saw some major political divides at the center of, really as a center of a reshaping of life in our country, which includes includes the world that I was focused on in business, and it also includes a lot of political issues I really care about. So New Founding is a for-profit company that I started with Matt Peterson, who was the founder of the American Mind and associated with Claremont. New Founding is a media and investment company with a broad portfolio I can talk a little bit about in those spaces. And our broader goal is building what we call a digital commonwealth, which is a network designed to advance the common good of its members, specifically in this case, the good of the American people. So it's built out of a critique of how really even the design of a lot of tech networks and how those are organized. So the media and investment are largely drawing people into toward this new view of how we should organize life in a digital age. And that really is it's a very broad project. Starts with a recognition that we are sharply divided as a country and that those divides are increasingly shaping who you want to do business with, what life you want. Politics is no longer relegated to one part of life. So our early projects, which include a newsletter called Align, it's called the Align newsletter, which you can get at joinaline.us, is a weekly publication that'll offer you opportunities to buy from companies that don't hate you, at times do things like use technology that won't enslave you. And increasingly, that's becoming difficult for about half of Americans who regularly have brands spit in their face effectively with their marketing. And then there's a broader range of publications. The Masculinist is one that's part of our portfolio by Aaron Wren. That predated New Founding, but Aaron joined us last fall. And we will be very soon launching a sort of life in the digital age publication. How do you live as a human in the digital age? There's a lot of publications that start talking about technology. We approach that from the opposite perspective. It's not about technology. It's recognizing technology is changing the world, radically reshaping the world. How do you as a human live in that world, live well in the digital age? And then there's going to be a broader men's lifestyle publication, women's lifestyle publication, and more. So ultimately, what New Founding is doing is it's starting by painting a picture of a better way of life, or a term that we use as a more human way of life, in ways that aren't necessarily focused on traditional political issues, but are inherently political in the sense that political encompasses this broad sense of how we are organized together. We paint a better way of life. We draw people there. And then our goal is to offer more substantive ways to sort of further further live that life, including a network that can really replace a lot of the networks that are shaping digital life in a way that is antithetical to aspects of that life. So broad description of what is a really touching a lot of things and a very ambitious concept. I can go into American Reformer right now and how that fits in, or if you have any quick questions about that, then
What I was just going to say is, I mean, it's fascinating because I think, as you point out, what I would say at least is that people talk about the politicization of life, that every aspect of life has become political. I think, to my mind, we've just come to realize, at least I've come to accept, that actually it's true that a lot of our life is, in a sense, political. If you have a broad conception of politics or of political life, that it doesn't actually, it does encompass more of life. And it sounds like what you're doing, I should say also that we're also in a kind of a state of confusion where you have people like millennials kind of looking back at the boomer kind of lifestyle and the way they thought of the world, and that's kind of crumbling. And so it sounds like what you're doing is you're trying to provide, in a sense, a sort of like resources to figure out the good life in the midst of chaos, but it's also more practical. Does that sound about right? It's trying to help people, give people the resources, reliable information and advice, and play, like you said, you can go to these through a line. You go to companies that don't actually hate you, and and they don't have the whole corporate slave labor and all that. So does that sound like what New Founding is about? That sort of,
yes. So, and I would say you touched on two really important points there. So I think, in the midst of chaos is a great way to put it. In a way, both the digital disruption has broken down a lot of norms in ways that are inevitable and irreversible. And so we are in a more chaotic transition environment. Secondly, wokeism itself, what the left does is they systematically destroy the heuristics that help you understand how to navigate the world and how to live life, even many that may remain valuable. They systematically destroy heuristics that help you understand how to deal with the opposite sex, for instance. Hmm. So we're in a world that is really chaotic and is really, I think it can result in extreme anxiety because you don't have guidelines on things and you can't just logically think through everything. So yes, so you think of the masculinist, that does a great job of that in terms of recognizing the reality of the world we're in. It's not sort of, it's not just naively nostalgic. It's recognizing we're in a chaotic world and here's some, it's a world that's changed, as Aaron talks about, from the negative, from the neutral world for Christians, for instance, to the negative world, where our views are viewed a lot more unfavorably. And that requires a rethinking of how we do a lot of things. So here's some heuristics for how you can think about living life. So that's an important part, and that's going to touch all of our publications. But what people want is they want more than that. They want they actually ultimately, in a chaotic world, you want to be combining with others who have similar goals, a basic political instinct. And I would say there's several ways we're doing that. So one is on the commercial side. There's the basic analog, and I use Costco as a good example here. Costco, with a normal grocery store, for instance, you walk into the supermarket and it rents shelf space to national brands to push stuff on you. You don't really have a trust relationship with the grocery store so much as you recognize they're trying to sell you things. You're a fairly savvy consumer. It's great. Costco's much better because you go in there and you pay a membership fee and they effectively act as your agent. So I think generally, most people are very happy with what they get there. They trust that you have this several hundred billion dollar company whose procurement agents are negotiating on your behalf. They're sort of scouring the world to find the best value for the money for you within a certain value. And so if you share their values of what's good, which in the spaces they focus on is sort of aligned to a certain American taste, you essentially get the benefit of a very powerful company acting as your agent. And I think people on the right really, really want that. In a chaotic world, you want an agent acting on your behalf. And then I would say that the next level of that is we don't just act on your behalf collectively, but we actually help bring people together in a network that can gain the benefit of network effects, which really compound and multiply far beyond what a company can do just with economies of scale, and build a network with people who have similar goals and have similar vision of the good as they navigate this world, and really leverage, act as a champion on behalf of people. So first we lay out this picture of the good life. We lay out some basic advice, and then we act as your champion to help achieve it and fight off, sometimes fend off people who will be attacking you, evil organizations like Google that will try to impede that way of life.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. You might hear about some company that will offer you a product and you think they align with your values, and then it turns out that really they're just kind of exploiting. They're exploiting a certain demographic for profit. So it turns out in the end that they're really not on your side. They're just trying to exploit you. But to have, as you said, like this kind of agent on your side where you can trust them, and in a sort of chaotic world, I think that's something that is. I think you've tapped into a great idea, and moving that forward.
I'll touch on what you just said really quickly. I think you're absolutely right, and I think we're actually moving toward a world where courage and skin in the game will become a much larger share of what makes people drawn to brands. And I don't know if you're alluding to Black Rifle Coffee, for instance, as a good.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, yeah.
I would say it's a very grifty organization, and I think people, they sell to people. They sort of pretend to be right wing, or they have a very sort of kitschy version of right wing, and then when it comes time to actually stand up for those values, they just immediately rush to distance themselves from Kyle Rittenhouse, which is just a massive betrayal of what one would have thought their values are, certainly the values that they've sort of projected to their customer base. And then they've had some further statements that I think reinforce that. So you see that really it's a very shallow, it's a very image-driven alignment. I think image, the nature of digital transformation in a sense is image becomes cheaper and cheaper. It's cheaper and cheaper to produce images that portray a certain look or a certain value, sort of like that's what Black Rifle did, is they produced some funny videos, I guess, or entertaining videos. That means less and less in a world where more and more people can do that with a camera. And what remains a valuable signal in a digital age is something where there's skin in the game, where there's a real costly signal of alignment with the people you're selling to. And in a sense, courage is by very nature a costly signal, taking a risk on behalf of people. So I think you'll see, and I would say Patagonia actually does this somewhat well. Patagonia is continually trying to signal its tribal alignment with its customers who are on the left. So it'll do things like ban energy companies from buying its vest and putting their logo on its vest to show just how pure they are. And that's costly. You're turning away customers. That means something. And yet it reinforces the signal to its core customers that we are willing to make a costly signal that we are part of your tribe. And I think more and more savvy people are recognizing that image is cheap, and courage is what you really want. And so that's fully our intent. We are going all in on this, and I think you'll see a sort of a separation of those that are willing to take a stand when it's costly, and those that try to sell to the conservatives, sell to the right without that.
Yeah.
Nate, when you look out at businesses for potentially aligning with them, what are some key elements that tip you off that this might be a good business to work with, to invest in, or to join up with you guys?
So I think there's different levels. So using the Align newsletter, it's very contextual. Some businesses will openly take a stand. They'll openly embrace our values. On the other hand, in today's environment, a mere refusal to bend the knee itself signals something and signals something costly. So one example, and we didn't work with this business closely, but we featured them, is in June, we recommended, we have a better alternative section, and we recommended Krispy Kreme, disrecommended Dunkin' Donuts. And you go to their Twitter profile and Dunkin' had a rainbow flag on it. So it had turned its logo rainbow. Krispy Kreme had not. In today's environment, you know that both of those were very conscious decisions by those companies. Do I know where Krispy Kreme stands on everything? No, I don't. But I know that they chose not to bend the knee in a way that many corporations did. So that itself signals something. I think another one is brands that just stick to quality and really focus on delivering good products at high quality, especially if it's sort of great craft made in America brands. There's some great companies that are often associated with founders who tend to have conservative viewpoints, but are not necessarily super political. And I'm happy to endorse those companies. I mean, they're providing great value. Then I would say, in terms of explicit alignment, that'll be a broad range. That'll become there'll be companies that are addressing something that's a critical need for the movement. So I'm very interested in, say, technology companies that can provide payment services that we can feel confident are not going to cancel, are not going to participate in increasingly politicized censorship is a good one. Certainly, companies that provide things that align with our understanding of the good, where that diverges from, let's say, a mainstream consumeristic understanding of the good, that's something that I'll appreciate and feature. So it can be a pretty broad range. And then I would say another one is companies that are willing to, in their advertising, and this is something that not a lot of people have the capacity to do yet. And here's another one, right? In-N-Out actually did a costly signal when they rejected the vaccine mandate and refused to police that. That was a courageous rejection of a totalitarian government order that cost them to have to shut down their restaurant, I think, for at least some time, and stood up to something that's going to get them a lot of hatred in California, which is their base. That's a great effort on an issue that's obviously a sharply divided issue today. And then going to the advertising, I would say a company that features a normal family, a healthy, normal family regularly in its advertising is a good example that it's almost banned in mainstream advertising.
Right, that's rare. That's rare.
So, yeah. When they're spending money trying to make people aspire to a particular way of life, that's what marketing generally does.
Right.
And I expect them to use that money to sell people on a good way of life, a way of life that's compatible with what we understand as the good.
Sure. Stephen, this gets us into the question of institutions. Do you want to move there?
Let's hear about American Reformer.
Okay.
Sure.
We can jump into.
So American Reformer is an organization that its most public element right now is a new publication, which is a journal that has elements and it's edited by Ben Dunson, former seminary professor. I co-founded it with Ben and with Aaron Wren. And our broad mission is focused on challenging some pathologies in the church, in the evangelical church, that are really worldly pathologies, especially related to feminism, related to race, related to how sexuality is approached, and general bringing sort of elite establishment views into the evangelical church. And our goal is to challenge that broadly, both at the institutional level, which we'll touch on our next conversation, and through a publication that just presents a better model, largely drawing on historical Protestant. I think the publication is heavily drawing on historical Protestant views on these things, on things like politics and culture, which diverge sharply from what you would see in evangelical publications today, like the Gospel Coalition and Christianity Today. And the publication is sort of a Protestant First Things would be one way to think of it, but there'll be elements that are a little closer to the Gospel Coalition in terms of explaining style, maybe elements of the American mind in terms of a willingness to lean into some provocative topics and framing. But really, the defining feature is we're taking a very different perspective than you're going to find in the evangelical publications like the Gospel Coalition. And then where I see it in, with respect to the movement is, I mean, one big concern on the right is we need to win and we need to be right. Both things that are crucial if we're going to achieve anything. And right obviously needs to be in accordance with Christian principles. And so I think there's a few risks. One risk is that the right ends up being led by ungodly leaders, not just, I mean, and it's politics. We're going to elect people who are effective, whether they're perfect people or not. No one's perfect. But we want the movement to continue to be shaped by a Christian understanding of what our goals are, because otherwise it's not even necessarily good what it achieves. Second of all, we're a Protestant country. We're by far a majority Protestant country. We're a historically Protestant country, even to the extent a lot of people aren't as religious. And as Aaron Renz noted, the conservative intellectual movement has traditionally had Protestants as third-class citizens. I mean, we've been really marginalized. And what you end up heavily is heavily Catholics, is heavily often foreigners who come over. And so I think what you end up with is you end up with an intellectual elite who is just, they're presenting a vision that is not aligned with the spirit of our country in many ways, just culturally in certain ways. It's different. And I think that's not a recipe for effective leadership of a movement. It's less likely to persuade even the same issue, even a very similar issue like pro-life, I think, is less likely to persuade people if it's framed, it's more likely to persuade people if it's framed in a way that is rooted in a classic Protestant understanding of how we should, the purposes of government, how we should think of questions of natural law and morality from a Protestant perspective. That's going to resonate culturally with evangelicals and with people with a Protestant heritage in a way that it may not if it's coming from a different perspective. So our goal is to bring back, and I think it aligns with a lot of what you're doing, bring back this Protestant understanding of politics in a way that can provide a degree of leadership on the right, which will set us up for victory.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about like the conservative movement, the intellectual conservative movement, you have someone like Hazzoni. And I mean, what's interesting, it's listening to him talk, it often sounds like he's explaining Protestant theology to Roman Catholics. You know, so you got, he got a room with, he's this nationalist, but he says, look, Protestantism, Reformation was good. And then he's talking to Roman Catholics. And then you talk to Protestant intellectuals, and they're all kind of obsessed with Roman Catholic intellectuals. But there are, and American Reformer is one example of this. There are several groups of people, kind of Protestant, you know, I guess academics or intellectuals or whatever, trying to kind of reassert Protestantism as no, that there is an intellectual force to. We can be confident in ourselves. We don't constantly be needing to, you know, looking over and see what the Roman Catholics are doing. That we can actually ourselves have an intellectual life that we proudly proclaim as Protestant. So I think American Reformer is part of that. I think you have like Davin Institute's part of that. And other projects in the works are like that as well. So it's, yeah. I think being an influence on the right as well, if you think of the right wing, you think of, okay, you have some kind of, you have the post-liberal Roman Catholics, you have the pagan right, whatever you want to call them, the sort of neo-pagan right. But there isn't a strong influence of intellectual Protestant right wing. There is kind of that, let's go back to the 16th, 17th century and see what they said. But there's not kind of this coherent Protestant right that's arising. But I think that's changing. So
I'm going to look at Hungary as a good example. Hungary is in some ways the model that a lot of people look to as here's an example of a country that's challenged some of the pathologies of liberalism and de facto, I think Hungary is shaped by a sort of Christian understanding of the nation that aligns with the Protestant. And Viktor Orban is a Calvinist. He's the only Calvinist head of state in the world. So, and you read his, we republished an interview with him, and he articulates a understanding of the purposes of government that is fully in line with the Protestant political theory. And he's obviously very popular with a lot of the groups you mentioned, including the Catholic post-liberals, because they recognize that it's effective and it's challenging the errors they recognize.
Right. And I've very recently talked to some Roman Catholics, and after actually in the middle, I didn't discover that they're Roman Catholic until the middle of the conversation, but there is this appreciation for some like Viktor Orban and Hungary. But like you said, it's a very much a Protestant sort of nationalism. It's not, he's not appealing to the Pope. He doesn't recognize that there's this international institution called the Church that we need to appeal to for political disputes or anything like that. So there's no kind of traditional old school Roman Catholic. It's just, it's kind of this nationalism that you see there. And like Hazzoni and other people have pointed out that this is very kind of a Protestant arrangement. But anyway, let's get into, well, Thomas, you got any questions about that? We can move into institutions. Okay. So you're obviously starting institutions, beginning these two institutions. There's kind of this dispute that's on the right wing about whether you build institutions or you kind of take over or you try to infiltrate or whatever, you try to take them back. So what is your view on that? I guess you don't have to choose one side or the other, but if you could talk about that, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
So I'll say I found a piece that Aaron Wren wrote, I think maybe a year and a half ago, fairly convicting. It was a piece that talked about the conservative tendency to exit, the conservative Christian tendency to exit, and in some ways the American tendency to exit institutions. And the costs of that, and really, I think it's titled "Christians Should Be on the Advance, Not the Retreat," and that changed my thinking a little bit from probably the legacy sort of libertarian bias to exit. And at the same time, I'm starting new organizations, and I'm starting the organizations, but the purpose of them is. Even when there's an exit, it's a sort of retrenchment to disrupt. And I think that there's sort of a Silicon Valley approach to exit, which is often a sort of exit and disrupt versus often the conservative Christian approach to exit is we will sort of exit and be this last remnant that maintains a little spark of purity, sort of accepting our inevitable decline in history, and maybe we'll mirror the cops or something who have seen their numbers, I think, slowly decline for 1400 years. So I think there's a strategic exit, which is not that different than actually try to capture something or try to move the institution. It's just a decision of how to approach it. And that's the one that I'm very sympathetic to. So within the Church, for instance, as I mentioned, American Reformer is. It's a new publication, but it's a publication that's aimed at reaching a lot of people in elite institutions. And other parts of what American Reformer is doing is American Reformer is actually looking to organize political actions within, whether when there's a battle within a denomination, for instance. I want to be in a position where we can help orchestrate support for, let's say, Orthodox Christians who are opposing Revoice type movements within the PCA, because often you have people within these institutions who lean left. And I'll use the CRC, the Christian Reformed Church, as an example. They have a report on sexuality that is going to be voted on next summer. And the denomination itself is doing things like organizing, I believe, listening tours of people who will be affected by this. The report would be a reassertion of the Orthodox doctrine that basically just a statement that it is confessional in nature, that the confessions do in fact prohibit homosexuality, homosexual behavior, which is a pretty straightforward and basic thing. But the institution itself is orchestrating things that appear to be designed to undermine this report, no doubt because the sort of people you find in these denominations tend to be liberals, certainly the ones who are focusing on politics. So who's going to expend those? And guess what? They're experts in things like procedure and politics. They've been playing politics within a denomination. That's probably how they got there. They're experts at orchestrating things like this. So what does the right have? The right often has, I mean, they actually have a great organization within the CRC that's opposing this, but it's a bunch of pastors part-time, my brother's on it, that have other jobs, other primary jobs, and they're not necessarily trained political operatives who know how to bring people together and know how to whip up votes and know how to engage in persuasion and all that. And all those are important competencies that if we believe our cause is true, we should be fighting for that. We should be willing to use our talents and deploy the utmost professional resources to win these fights and protect the integrity of these institutions. So our goal is to be able to actually help help be an organization and a hub that can help organize many of these, ranging from maybe individual churches to Christian colleges to denominations to sort of anything where the institution's at stake. And I would say the same certainly applies, and I could get into a lot more with New Founding on the economic side, but I definitely think we need to fight for them.
So one of the common critiques of conservatives you have from the right is that they're not they don't actually know how to use their power. They don't know how to, or they're unwilling, or they don't have the spirit for it, or they're always kind of they're trying to achieve civility and peace and neutrality within organizations, when really the other side is playing for keeps, playing to win. And so in the end, what you have is you have the conservatives lose, because the conservatives think in terms of neutrality and universality and all that, whereas the left sees a chance to exploit and to win. So I think what you're getting at is that the conservative / right wing folks in these institutions need to organize, need to be more political in a sense, need to, like you said, apply their talents so that they can shape these institutions. But that seems to be, I mean, one of the I've heard before is that the reason why liberals win is because they're just simply more political. They're the ones who are going to go in the streets, or the ones who are going to make these great spectacles. Whereas conservatives they might put up a fuss on Twitter or Facebook, but they won't do anything about it. The NFL says, we basically hate you. But a year later, they're watching the NFL again. LeBron James says he laughs at Rittenhouse. A year later, conservatives watching NBA again. So there is something, there's a critique I think we have to have on the right, and we do this all the time, but I think conservatives need to take to heart that in order, if there's going to be any sort of success in shaping institutions, we have to have the spirit to actually win, right? I mean, would you agree that that's...
Yeah,
I think that's what begins on the right.
That's absolutely right. Now, I think that there's a debate over whether boycotts are ever really all that effective. And I think whether they're an effective tactic for the right. And often we need to be willing to use power in ways that are even more aggressive than boycotts. I mean, I love the sometimes the political responses like, is there a way that you can actually punish the team for they're an institution? It's sort of assumed that the people there are probably going to associate with or probably going to follow the institution, but take away their tax subsidies, certainly be much more aggressive about taking them away if they're using their platform and using their resources and their power to take values that are to assert values that are hostile to the values of your community.
Yeah, so tax the university endowments, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, it's insane. It is insane that the right does not recognize the left is extremely effective at rewarding their friends and their allies and channeling. I mean, a huge part of what Biden's infrastructure, so-called infrastructure bill is channeling money to friends and allies, like their school initiative. It explicitly excludes, in a way that I'm sure is unconstitutional and will probably be struck down, but it excludes sectarian institutions, but it gives money to preschools and schools, primary schools and such, to encourage, which naturally are encouraging the institutionalizing of children and are full of people who are political allies of the Democrats. So the least we can do is undo, which the universities are one of the most obvious examples of this. The least we can do is undo these advantages that the Dems have given to very left-wing institutions. But I think we should think about taking that a step further, and we should recognize institutions that advance a good as we understand it and favor them.
So on that front, I guess this moving on from kind of institutions, I mean, this is related, but in terms of the American right, what do you see in terms of, so how do we proceed on the American right with the changes that we've, so this is post-Trump, how do we go forward? I mean, there's a lot of energy on the right, at least online. It's hard to say on the ground how much energy there is, though. With the exception of the school board, the people showing up to school boards of fighting CRT and some other stuff like that. There's also been some successful movements against CRT. Just generally with someone like, was it Chris Rufo? So where do you think, given our experience the last year or two, what do you think is the path forward for the right?
Well, I think you're right that there's a ton of energy, and it is heavily online. And I think the CRT is actually an interesting example where Chris Rufo is very, very active online. He's very active on Twitter. And yet that energy is heavily shaping the school board, the actual on the ground victory. So I think that increasingly our world is being shaped digitally, and online energy and online organization is actually a key way. It's a natural way for us to organize too, as many offline institutions are captured and hostile to us. So I think we should expect that we are going to primarily come together and organize online. Now, the key is turning the energy that exists online into organization and action that actually has real world impact and does not sort of stop at posting and getting angry online or whatever. So, but there's energy, and you have some very thoughtful people rising. I mean, that goes to the heart of what New Founding is doing, which is how do we build media that really brings out some of the messages that are resonating with people and are resonating with the right, and that often the legacy right is just blind to, fails to recognize, they either fail to recognize the importance of the space, or they repeat fairly trite slogans or just messages that might have actually been good messages in the 80s, but they're not good messages today. And so we can articulate those messages, and then by articulating those messages, we reach a lot of people, and we can bring them together and organize them in broader ways. And then there's other candidates who are doing a great job of that too. There's people who I think are generating a lot of excitement, like Blake Masters and JD Vance, who are willing to say some of the things that very few other Republicans are saying that that match where the base recognizes what the base recognizes matters. So, as an example, they both put out strong statements on Kyle Rittenhouse, which is someone who has not been touched, as far as I've seen, by most of the Republican political establishment. They're both willing to challenge policy norms in line with the base. So I think you have both a new breed of candidates, and then you have others like what we're doing in other domains looking to really bring people together around these new messages.
some of the J.D. Vance, I was kind of unsure about him for a while. But Blake Masters is from what I could tell, is great. They're the sort of people who they seem to know what we're up against. It's kind of like watching Tucker Carlson. You know, like this guy gets it. And then you switch to Sean Hannity, he's still talking about socialism and tax cuts and that sort of thing. So, but I mean, people like Tucker and as kind of that media voice, Blake Masters, J.D. Vance, it's as if they kind of get where we're headed. They get the nature of the left. They understand what's really at stake at our current time, and they're willing to actually say it. So they're willing to actually defend someone like Rittenhouse. That they're willing to say that, you know, CRT and that the Virginia governor race was about just kind of not just a referendum on Biden, but it was also on this racial stuff that they're pushing schools. And then what is a GOP post on Twitter the day after? Oh, the people have spoken and they don't like socialism. You know, so they completely, the like you said, the legacy media and the GOP establishment, they don't get what people, conservatives, are begin to realize what's at stake now. But then there's these guys who really do get it. And that's, it's reassuring. I tend to be very kind of black pillish pessimistic, but then you see where people are starting to get it. They're being very public. They say it out loud. And so it's encouraging.
Absolutely. I think it's very significant that I actually think I'm positive. I think it's probably inevitable that it's probably inevitable. As I talked about sort of this move toward courage with brands, I think we're going to see the same with politicians. I think we have a base that is extremely disillusioned with people who make sort of gestures in their direction, but then betray them. And so I think we're going to see a base that is, they increasingly prize loyalty. And I think, despite what a lot of people say, I think will appreciate competence as well. But they recognize that loyalty, even from someone who might be less professional, is more valuable than professionalism without that recognition of what time it is and what loyalty. So I give them a lot of credit. I think we'll see a move toward leaders who really understand the times, demonstrate a loyalty to the really the interests of the American people and the interests of the people who are the base that's electing them, and take some hard stands to demonstrate that.
Yeah, I agree. Nate, you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that loyalty is going to be valued over more highly than things like putting out images and which becomes devalued over time. And that rings true with me and a lot of people I know. When I see someone like Tucker or some business that are really putting their neck on the line to be loyal to their base or a message that they've held to in the past, that goes very far, and there's a trust that's established there. And so I appreciate what you're doing in trying to bring together some of those different messages and different people to join together rather than having them all be scattered. It just seems like there's pockets of people doing this, and it without any kind of network or way of organizing ourselves, you sort of have this hope flicker in yourself when you see that, but then there's nothing you can do about it because there's no one you can reach out to and connect with. There's no, like, for instance, banking. You mentioned you're looking for someone who would be able to help in that. I mean, that would be fantastic, but without something like that, you have that avenue cut off to you, and you sort of have this anxiety that you mentioned. And to be able to establish those lines of communication and organization go really far.
Absolutely. And I think that part of it has been, it's not organized. There's a few things. I think one thing is the goal of censorship itself is to kind of cut off they know that you can't completely suppress messages today. Online is impossible to suppress messages, but it's, I think, sufficient to censor people whose voice ends up providing a point of organization. And the biggest consequence of censorship is you actually just scatter the right. You end up with either sort of platform leaders who are ultimately going to have a framing that is not effectively challenging the left, or is actually, I mean, sometimes even conciliatory toward it, or playing to their goals, or you'll end up with sometimes crazies, and they'll actually happily platform. I think this was actually intentionally done during the Soviet era with, I believe, religious people and certainly dissidents, is they would allow the ones who are either co-opted, and they would allow the crazies who are going to make the other side look as bad as possible. And what they're not going to allow is they're not going to allow the serious, credible people who are going to organize people and can't be dismissed as crazy. I think you see who the sort of most vehemence is directed at. And it's often people who actually have that potential be seen. So, I mean, a good example is Jordan Peterson, right? Jordan Peterson was, I mean, I don't know what he's actually said this controversial, very, very mildly controversial thing from a sort of cancelable standpoint. But clearly he's... clearly, someone who rejects some of their dogmas, and he's someone who gains an enormous following, and he's someone who can't be dismissed as crazy. And so he was recognized as a threat. J.K. Rowling was recognized as a threat, too, because when you have someone that powerful who refuses to submit to the mob, that demonstrates the mob's weakness. And so they get just unbelievably vehement in their attempts to destroy those people because they are seen as... they can have nothing else, just be a focal point that brings together people. And I think when it comes to like real leaders, and Tucker's obviously the ultimate example, one of the great examples of this, someone who can really lead in many ways the right, they are, and who's going to do so in a way that's very thoughtful and in a way that's very strategic, they're terrified of people like that, because that's the greatest threat, is if that does organize a movement more. And that's ultimately what we're focused on. And we're focused on that in the business and technology world, which is one that is, I think, where the people can be brought together in ways that can directly lead to action, even outside of the voting side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've often thought that memes, they're nice, and then people talk about mimetic warfare and things like this, but there's also a sense in which it's inert as far as action is concerned. You get online, you send some memes, you attack your enemy, and but then you don't actually build anything in life. You don't get out there and organize with others. So I don't want to knock people doing memes or whatever, but I'm just saying there's a sense in which it doesn't go any further than that. It's deconstructive perhaps, but it's not constructive in any sense. And you feel like you've done your duty, but you haven't really done much in life to help others and connect with others.
Yeah, and I think it's great. I think it's good that people do that. As you say, it's deconstructive. And I think now is the time to be deconstructive of a lot of institutions that need to be thoroughly discredited and torn down. But it's insufficient. It's a small share. And especially as conservatives, I think the left can get away with deconstruction playing a much, much larger share of their mission, because essentially their mission is largely deconstructive, maybe entirely. Whereas on the right, we can't. I think we have to recognize that there are times that you use guns and bombs when you're threatened, right? When you're threatened by a foreign country, you do need to defeat them. But that's not that's not our purpose in life. Our purpose in life is not just to tear down some bad institutions, defeat some bad people. Our purpose in life is to it's not even to defeat foreign adversaries. Our purpose in life is to build a great civilization and to glorify God. And that requires, those are positive things that are not satisfied by the deconstructive side. And I think if we're not actively doing that, and you could say now is a time when we need a lot more deconstruction, when we are faced with threats, it's sort of a time where we are engaging in much more of that wartime mentality. But even so, a huge part of our mission is to persuade people there's a better way of life. And we can only do that. We can only do that by actually demonstrating that better way of life, which must remain a positive effort in many ways. And because we're not purely individualistic, it must remain a positive effort even beyond what a few isolated people can do in their homestead or whatever, but we actually have to show what a society and what a civilization can look like in a way that's aspirational. And that requires a lot of collective positive action.
All right, on that great note, we're going to end here. Thank you, Nate, for joining us and talking with us. I know your time's precious. You can check Nate's workout at American Reformer and also join a line and find him on Twitter. He's pretty active. And thank you again, Nate. Take care.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks, Thomas.
Liquor tastes sweeter in this town. Could it be it's the same as the last? I swear I've seen your face elsewhere before, just as familiar as a bottle and a glass. Hey, darling, sleeping on the blacktop.